In today's episode of Be the Husband She Brags About podcast, we welcome in Four Arrows. Author of 23 books, Four Arrows is internationally known for his work in worldview studies, education, critical theory, and wellness. Currently a professor of educational leadership at Fielding Graduate University, Four Arrows, aka Donald Trent Jacobs, is a maid relative of the Oglala Lakota tribe. He lives with his wife of 40 years, B, in Mexico and British Columbia, where eco-activism, surfing, handball, horses, music, and grandchildren are important focuses. With that, let's begin. So all you kings listening in, it's with like absolute anticipation and excitement for me to welcome Four Arrows onto the podcast. Four Arrows, you're so welcome, sir.
Well, it's an honor to be here, and from Mexico to Ireland we are.
And you say it's an honor to be here. It's like an absolute honor and a privilege to have you on due to your commitment. I just want to give a little bit of a back here because the unfolding natural raw, I think the situational elements that you had to overcome, modern life, you didn't have, 4 hours didn't have reception at his home base, and he ended up traveling two towns or cities away to finally get the necessary bandwidth to make this call happen. So I just really wanted to honor you, 4 hours, and just let the guys listening in just know the embodied commitment and enthusiasm and passion for what you're going to be speaking to, just that level of embodied commitment that brought you here to make this happen. So thank you for that.
Well, you know, they used to say Indian time, you know, show up whenever. And I've learned from my many years with many different cultures, like the Tarahumara of Mexico, the Rarámuri, the Kogi of Colombia, that's a different story. The real story is a respect for people. And, I always like to joke that the Lakota and other tribes never would have beat Custer had they said, you can show up anytime.
Brilliant. Four Arrows, we spoke a little bit about it just before. I'm curious, as an Irishman, take me a little bit deeper. I know in your book, I think there's two parts to this. There's a quote in your book: as an Irishman with unproven Cherokee heritage, I was made a relative of the Oglala Lakota. The first part of that, I'm a little bit curious as an Irishman. What's your Irish heritage background? Could you just get me up to speed with that?
Well, sure. My cousin is a physician in Arizona, and he spent quite a lot of time doing our lineage and our history. And turns out that a woman was my grandmother, who was an orphan and who was brought from County Kildare when she was 16 to a Christian school and missionary in New Orleans. And she married a riverboat captain there. And that was the background. So we are mostly Irish, according to my cousin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. And I think the second part of that quote, and I have such a deep fascination to understand the story of how you were made a relative of the, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, the Oglala Lakota.
Oh yes, you are. Oglala Lakota is perfect. Well, there's seven sacred ceremonies that the Lakota have. The sun dance is probably, they're all sacred. We think of the sun dance as perhaps the most sacred one, the purification lodge, etc. And one of them is a hunkpapa that's called the making of a relative. You know, with the blood quantum problematics that the U.S. government and other governments have fostered upon indigenous people, it was a divide and conquer strategy. And individuals who would be of the right heart, who were adopted for whatever reason into a tribe, they, like the Lakota say, that Yeah, you may like your Irish and Cherokee background for arrows, but where your spirit's going is where the Oglala go. And so they take the extended Teospaye, we call it, the family, very, very seriously. And so after my fourth Sundance, I was involved in a relative making ceremony and was given the name Wahinkpe Topa, which means four arrows, based on a vision that I had on an Ombletcheye, which is another sacred ceremony, a vision quest. And I'm equally proud of my Irish ancestry, and although I know little of it, and I know little of my Cherokee ancestry, only that a woman who was also 16 escaped from the Trail of Tears in Missouri near Marys County, and was adopted by the Caldwells and was given the name Rachel. So Rachel Caldwell, we have a photo of her. But that's pretty much all we know, which is kind of a typical sad story about, how people have either lost their heritage or family stories or don't count anymore because of blood quantum requirements. And now Indians are against Indians, about who has got more Indian in them, right? So it's part of the colonizing process. But the United Nations essentially says that Indigenous identity is based on two things: one, self-identity, and two, an acknowledgement of that identity by the tribe or nation that person is claiming identity with.
There's a part of me within your self-identity, and I speak to it. I speak to it. I think there's a part of me almost hesitant to speak to it, but I do really definitely in your presence want to open with it and maybe invite guys listening in. It's like, I don't know if I'm making a false assumption, but I feel that there's a whisper in me, and there's a whisper and maybe not even a roar in some guys of some Indigenous ancestry. I've always experienced from an early age, looking at the likes of films like Dances with Wolves, and there's always been this deep calling inside of me. I know from a young age, I think if you want to say my late teenage years, early adulthood, I was just totally encapsulated, intoxicated by by modern culture. I had really lost any spiritual connection with myself in a conscious level. Yet I'll tell you this story just to to speak to it. And I'm wondering just to your feedback and insights and meanings to it for arrows. But I think about 6 years ago, I've been doing certain deep meditative practices, and I started learning to, tap in that if my mind was giving me signs, that there was a meaning there. And for about 10 years previous to this, I was having visions of myself performing the Haka, the New Zealand Maori, what sort of on a world level is called, like would be known as the All Black, the New Zealand All Black rugby teams, that Haka. And I was having these visions of that. And for so many years, I just thought, Mark, like any red-blooded male that's into sport, definitely in Europe, Southern Hemisphere, there's a lot of association. The All Blacks would be very well known. I sort of put it off. I was like, that's just a guy thing. But this evening, there was something different about the quality. I think just the vision came to me very potently with great clarity, so much so that I walked downstairs 4 hours into the room with my queen, and I literally just looked at her and I said, hey, I'm going to find a man from New Zealand. It's like preferably a Maori tribe member to teach me the Haka. And my queen, being my queen, she's like, yeah, you do that. I thought nothing off at 4 hours, but literally, I think it was about 2-3 days later, I received an email. Now, just within the context, and excuse me, I just want to, I keep it as concise as possible, but there's a certain sacred context to this. We were living in a very rural small village in Ireland. Now, I mean small, small village. And I got this email coming through that in the local center, in the local art center, there was a Maori master shaman healer who was attending for one day. It was his only visit that he was making in a short trip to Ireland. And part of that day is he would be teaching the Hakka. And my mind just, I thought, wow, this is uncannily clear. There's something meant to be. And cut a long story short, I went to the day. I didn't say anything to him. He taught us the Hakka, and it was Oscuelge in the Irish language. He wanted to do his he four he healing powers Hakka, but there was an Irish scholar there, so we could translate it Oscuelge to bring the full, I suppose, native potency to it. And it was only at the end of the day that I turned to Mauta, was the name of this Maori man. I just asked him, it's like, Mauta, when did you decide to come to Ireland? And he literally just looked at me. He was like, it was on that day, effectively the day that I had that vision come true. He's like, my spirits came to me, Mark, and my spirits told me, you've got to go to Ireland. And how did you decide to come to Arda? It's like, my spirits guided me. I wanted to share that story with you, Four Arrows, because it's, reading your book has just really brought back such a remembrance in me of this sacred story that has come up, that is so to so many levels of my education and upbringing, completely inexplicable. But I wanted to just invite you into my relationship with, I suppose, in indigenous culture within me, and I'm wondering what insights you have or what meaning you would give that story I experienced.
Well, thank you for sharing. It's a sacred story, and I thank you for sharing it. Inexplicable is actually a good word in Indigenous worldview because we believe strongly in the great mysterious thing, and accept that there is, I guess, what we could say now is there's no such thing as coincidence, that things are spirit driven in ways that we don't understand. But I've seen the so-called miracles and unexplicable happening so many times. I've given into that idea. Visions. My first doctoral dissertation, I waited for my professors to finish evaluating it for almost a month, and finally it was in my box, and I looked at it and it said, "See me in my office. This is either brilliant or it's bullshit." And it took a couple of years. Took a couple of years for one guy to get over it, but I got it. But it was because my first dissertation was based on a vision that I had. And that's very rare as a data source in the academy, of course, right? But eventually they came to accept it because, I used the academic things to support it. So your story, the first thing I want to say is you've had indigenous people in Ireland for 33,000 years, right? And so if you have any ancestors from Ireland, then you're close to your indigeneity. I ask people often when I present, I say, raise your hand if you are an indigenous person, you have indigenous ancestry. And very few will raise their hand out of fear of playing Indian or misstating their identity or knowing that they're German or whatever. But ultimately, I'll get them all to raise their hand by saying, go a little back further, go a little back further, right? Because all of us are indigenous to this planet. And so that resonance that one has comes from that memory cells of the DNA. And more, people used to come to Pine Ridge Reservation from all over the world and share similar stories with me. So it's important to honor that, and that your time with the Maori was part of that magic.
There's so many different places. I think my challenge here is with in a man who embodies so much wisdom, and actually just in having read your book, the restoring the kinship worldview, it brought tears. Very few books have brought tears to my eyes. I can get cognitively engaged, I can get even excited, but to bring me to tears several times throughout the reading of it is just how emotionally touched I was by it. And like, it's my full active encouragement to every man listening in. It's such an impactful book. Part on a practical level, Four Arrows, I know myself, there's within my own upbringing and my healing journey, I know there's been such a resistance to authority within me, being told what I am allowed to say or not allowed to say, what I should think, believe, etc., etc. And a lot of my journey has been, you know, going beyond, call it the social institutions, you know, religious practices, into my own spiritual, you know, my own meaning, and unschooling our girls, and how I married Matilda. Like, there was no witnesses. It was God, the universe, call it the mysterious force, witnessing both of us committing together. And yet there is this back of this hierarchical society that myself and men listening in have grown up in. Part of your book, and you spoke to the instinctive submission to authority from early life trauma. I'd love if you could speak to that, to give a context to us all listening in, and myself included. You know, we've grown up in this culture. There's been a lot of authorities, from the education system to the healthcare system to religious authorities to, you know, authoritarian parenting, etc. So economic authoritarianism, etc., etc. How does that show up in the modern man in a way that he can recognize? Like, what are the, if you want to say, the signs and the symptoms to say that a guy could be listening going, I've no issue with authoritarianism, I've no issue, like, I'm actually fine. But how would instinctive submission to authority show up? Like, what would be the signs that you would see in modern men of this type of behavioral inclination?
It would be a colonized mindset. And by colonized, I'm talking about a time when pre-conquest consciousness was replaced with a post-conquest consciousness that was susceptible to and exposed to a kind of oppression of authority, do this, you're my slave, whatever level of that happens. And there's none of us that cannot say that at some level we are at the mercy of some authority figure in our work and our hypnotic responsiveness to a father figure or a religious figure. And so how it manifests itself is that we do unto others as is being done unto us. And we do it with our child rearing. We do it with our sense of competition. We do that with so many levels to show this trying to regain our liberty, our freedom, our sense of autonomy. It's a very unusual description of indigeneity to say it is a combination of autonomy and collectivism. It's kind of hard for people who have been brought up in an authoritarian system to get a handle on that. That autonomy, I've never, in all the time I've spent with a number of Indigenous people who have, against all odds, held on to their traditional ways, because it's, of course, being lost rapidly as the language is. But I noticed I've never seen anybody as autonomous, as independent, and not having been raised with Indigenous people, I always heard that they were like, it was a collectivist mentality. And so at first it was surprising to see such autonomy. But the difference is that in a authoritarian world, a hierarchical world, the autonomy is designed to be for self. In other words, we want to do it with as much autonomy stuff as we can, because we don't want to be too authorized, our life too authorized by others. So we struggle, and we try to do things to be free and independent, and yet for indigenous cultures, it's not for self. That autonomy ultimately is for the interconnected harmony with all life. And so you can't get that without freedom. Now, hierarchy, for example, in the Lakota culture, it was a non-hierarchical culture with an emphasis on matriarchy and matrilineal, who the women, you know, there's not too many drive-by shooters in the world that are women. And so we can assume that there is a more nurturing side to the feminine, just as there is to our solar and lunar selves, that we have this lunar side that, and women have this solar and lunar side. But the idea of balancing our autonomy with this nurturing, with this caring, with this wanting to bring everybody into oneness is where we are lost. And that's what, you know, that's what Darsha and I try to do with the book on restoring that worldview.
There was one line I was referring to, it's E. Richardson or Richard Sorensen. I hope I'm getting the name correctly. I'd like to read that, and it for myself as a father, and guys listening in, a lot of the majority of the guys listening in are husbands, and quite a few will already be dads or will probably have the intention of becoming fathers. But I wanted to read this, and this was one that brought me to tears. Sorensen's summation of so much experience he had with First Nation communities. I tried to find at least one case where a child's words were considered immature and therefore disregarded. No luck. And a gap. Even teenagers remain transparently upright, their hearts open wide for all to gaze inside. And the beauty in that, because there's been this challenge for myself and my queen in recent times, bit of context to yourself and the guys listening in, our eldest daughter is 12 now, and our youngest is 8. So, you know, Anya at the age of 12, she's coming into womanhood, if you want to say. She's physically and spiritually, biologically has stepped into womanhood. So there's quite a potent change and transformation and transition that she's going through. And yet there's such a modern idea of, you know, just disregarding, throw away. Oh, well, that's it. You know, like teenagers are going to be teenagers. Almost like there's this inherent characteristic of going through that period where, you know, your kid is just going to rebel against you. They're going to resent you. They're going to fight tooth and nail against everything that you have to offer them of advice, of guidance, you know. And this idea, myself and my queen were like, there must be a different way. There must be a way of relating as modern parents in the times that we live in, to connect with our kids in a way that, I suppose, that transparently upright, to use Sorensen's words, the transparently upright, heart open wide for all to gaze inside aspect that can come out. And yet it's quite a challenge. 4 hours, could you speak to, I suppose, an approach of from dads listening in, how can we consciously show up as men in the sacred sanctuary of our own home, in our family?
Well, I would say,
and communicate and come from a state of being that will allow that beautiful nature come true in a safe manner for our kids.
I would say that it's unabashed and open honesty and as Sorensen actually writes about this as well, you know, the idea that that this unabashed honesty is the foundation on which
our empathy and our rapport become possible. And it gives way to having empathy and rapport be dominant. Whereas, you know, the lack of honesty, we're in a post-truth world now. And that lack of honesty is where, you know, we tend to force others, especially children, to our will. And this is such a, you know, Darsha speaks to this as an expert in this field. It's such a disruptive and unwholesome practice. So how do we become so completely fearlessly honest? And the key is the word fearless. I found from the indigenous cultures that I've worked with that courage is a vital precept. And the highest expression of it is generosity. If you ask someone from the dominant worldview, hey, what's the biggest example of courage you can say? And it'll be something that relates to, you know, facing an enemy or an animal or some kind of, you know, jumping off a high place or something like that. But for indigenous cultures, it's generosity. To teach a child to give away its most valued puppy to someone because they've lost their father or something like that, and to let go of that. And that requires moving into courage, but moving from courage into what I like to call a fearless courage or a fearlessness, if you will. Most people think fearlessness is foolishness, but what I've learned is that fearlessness is a trust in the universe. So let me give a brief example. I had mentioned a high place in my example. Let's say that someone is going to show their courage by going up and jumping off a high place. We have a place on the west coast of Vancouver Island over a waterfall that's about a 30-foot jump, and where the bears go up and grab salmon, and I like to go up and jump off of it. But it's always a little frightening to, you know, after you've checked to make sure there's no logs in the way, the water's still deep and all that, you still get this little of fear. And then you bring up courage to make the jump. Well, if somebody goes up there that gets that courage, you know, they see a child do it in front of them, they know it's safe, but they're using everything they can to get the courage. Well, when they finally jump, there they go down, right? And it's like just still that they're still having to work that courage. And that takes a lot of energy. And so they fall through the air, hit the water, you swim out real fast. Now you get that person to start to think about this idea of ultimately trusting the universe. And you bring them up to the top again. And this time they get the courage to climb the rock. They get the courage to walk to the edge. They have the courage and the determination they're going to jump. But as soon as their feet leave the rock, at that moment, they switch into fearlessness. And now they see the eagle overhead. They see the salmon swimming underneath them. They feel the air coming up. They feel their toes hit the water and the plunge of the bubbles. And they feel the cold of the water in a delightful way. And I think, you know, I was giving a presentation up at University of British Columbia before the pandemic hit. And afterwards, people said, well, for us, do you think that if we all re-embrace our original worldview, like you say in this new book, I was at that time writing the book, and do you think we can turn things around? And I shocked everybody by saying, no, I don't think we can. I mean, it's possible, but I don't think the odds are very high. And you could just see, you know, all these people in the audience just like who were, I really had kind of optimistic about things, just have a tension on their face. Almost they didn't like me anymore, right? And so I think it's the idea of trusting the universe comes from a different definition of hope. And that hope is not the expectation of an outcome, the certainty that something good will happen. Hope is the certainty that whatever you're doing is the right thing to do, regardless of the outcome. And that's what I mean by this fearlessness. Now, if we could start with a fearless honesty, that's the only way relationships with children and with wives and husbands It's the only way it can work.
I know myself, when you're talking about the fearless honesty, and boy, oh boy, it'd be an overstatement to say that I have it to that level. But for years, my parenting with predominantly Leonia, I think she more got the momentum of my early years of parenting, where I just wasn't being honest. And I think the transition has been becoming fearlessly honest about what's actually live within myself. For so many years, I was like speaking to her about like changing her behavior. It was that authoritarian stuff. It was the patterns I learned growing up. It's like, you know, why are you upset? Almost like she was like, any emotional challenging experience she was having was upsetting me, because it was knocking me out of, it was creating an inconvenience for me. But the transition for me bit by bit was having the humility to just speak what was actually going on inside of me. And it's taken a number of years for her to actually stop dissociating and actually start listening and be able to receive. It's like, oh, Dad is not attacking me. Dad is not saying, you know, I'm inherently wrong no matter what I say, no matter what I feel. And just that gift of honesty has helped her to relearn a trust in me, but by extension, more in the world. So I can really tap in experientially just how transformative that has been in my parenting, but also by extension in my marriage with Matilda, just getting radically honest and having the courage to speak that.
And the best way to do that really is in nature. That's how indigenous people learned it initially. But Darsha, you know, has classes where she takes people out in nature and has them just, you know, based on John. And this, the more they tune in, the more they begin to feel that kind of empathetic humility, consciousness, honesty. It's difficult to lie to a tree or to a bird or to a snake or an ant that's nearby. And so, you know, this idea of, you know, of forcing children and being the boss, sometimes it's appropriate. For example, the Lakota are very, very permissive with their children, watch them, you know, very closely, but very permissive, non-authoritarian. But there will be times, for example, during the traditional buffalo hunt in days past, a person would be assigned to be the authoritarian figure, the leader for that hunt that day, be a different person for each hunt. And when they went back, that person lost that rank, if you will. So, you know, there are times in raising a child where one's authority has to be put forth for the sake of safety. But we have to know the difference, right? And I think that's another factor of honesty. We don't really know that difference because we're doing it out of convenience and a whole list of other things. We're making these decisions and rationalizing it's for the good of the child. So we have to be honest at that level, so we know when to be more of an authoritarian and when to be more of just an honest parent or sister or wife or, you know, whatever it is.
It brings me naturally on. I had a deep curiosity when I read in the book about respectful listening, the indigenous tribes, the elders' practice of respectful listening and just going into nature, creating like a deep space of inner silence within themselves whenever they listened to something that was challenging. Maybe there was a conflict going on that, could you speak to that as a practice for a man in relationship with his queen or with his kids, you know, within the confines of his own home? What does respectful listening look like in the practice from your perspective?
We of Colombia about 6 months ago, I guess, and went up to speak with them. And as I've seen with so many other people, I mean, the Aboriginal people, it's a deep, deep listening. Just a given that if you're going to be in religion and someone is using the sacred thing we call words, that deep listening is they learn that early on from, as you said, from nature and often for survival ultimately for helping be able to gather what is needed for the community.
Four arrows, my apologies. I'm just going to have to take a momentary break there. When you started answering about the respectful listening, the reception went really poor. Would you mind, if you can, to just start your answer on respectful listening again? I can edit this portion out. Excuse me, I'm just working with the reception we have. Are you hearing me your side now?
Yeah, are you ready for me to try now?
Yeah, perfect. So effectively, I'll do all the editing afterwards. Okay. Have my question answered to you if you can flow from your perspective on respectful listening. Thank you.
Well, I was over with the Kogi Mamos of Colombia, one of the few groups that are still holding on to the old ways, and had the honor to go up on the mountain to have a meeting with the men and women spiritual leaders. And, you know, I mean, these are people that go in a cave when they're babies for 7 to 9 years. So talk about listening. It was so similar to what I've seen with the Rarámuri people and the Aboriginal people refer to deep listening with a word. I think it's Dadiri. But it's comes from being in nature for survival and for taking care of the community. Listening is one of the major skills in survival and hunting, but it also is a spiritual phenomenon of respect. It's without deep listening to someone and not having an idea that you want to, you know, get out before they finish or whatever, like we usually do. And with that deep honesty, that combination is what truly allows relationships and differences to become complementary.
Yeah, if I think for so many years myself, and I get caught in it now much less, but I think most guys listening can resonate with this. Is, you know, when Matilda for years would be talking with me, and especially obviously in sort of in moments of conflict where there's a difference of opinion, it's got a bit heated, but, you know, when she'd be speaking, all that was present in my head was mental chatter about what my answer was to the initial thing that she was saying. There was literally no listening. So it was deeply moving just to hear that practice and the depth of it. And I also, the sacred nature that Indigenous people, the way they related with words being sacred instruments, that there was just such a sacredness with word that whenever you speak, you really make sure that it's complete, radical, honest in your perception in that moment when you land it.
Isn't that beautiful? It's so beautiful. That, I mean, it's Tom Cooper writes about that in a book called Time Before Just, what a great title. And he tells a story of how I don't remember whether it was Lakota or what, but it was when Europeans lied about treaties, that ceremonies were done by Indigenous peoples to pray for the healing of the person that obviously had a mental illness because they could not see reality. I love that story. You know, there's an old adage about, you know, there not being a word for lies. You know, there probably are now, but there's a lot of research that shows that that word didn't exist. It was inconceivable. And so this idea of conveying your best understanding of reality is really key. The vibrational frequency of prayer were part of that understanding. I mean, how could you lie to a great mysterious thing? How could you lie on behalf of being a good hunter today so that your family and community could eat, right? And so this total understanding of interconnectedness is really at the root of seeing words as sacred and truthfulness. I've written a lot of articles and chapters on this topic, and it's so crucial.
And 4 hours, how is it that, and like it's important to call it there again with being radically honest, it's lies. Because I know growing up, there was this thing of, you know, oh, it's just a white lie. It's like this socially accepted, almost part of the norms of society. It's like, oh, well, you know, lying is sort of, it's important socially, like almost like it's an everyday part of life. You've got to accept it. There's almost a virtue in it at times. But how is it that there's this almost omnipresent capacity of people to lie, from the little mundane things, or what seem to be little, albeit with this deepening of the conversation, I don't think there's any little lie from an Indigenous perspective, to the big lies, to the proper downright black and white lies for the sake of personal gain at the loss of a person, be that in one-on-one relationship, in marriage and parenting, to bigger economic scales, governments lying to people, the corporations lying to the world, etc. What's the root mechanism of that? And maybe from an individual level, you know, guys listening in, what would have shown up in their early formative years and childhood that they might have lost track with, but that became a root experience whereby lying actually had some benefit for them and the habit continued unwittingly? What would you speak to that?
Well, we are in a post-truth world big time. There's no question about that. And, you know, there was a pre-truth world, I think, and a truth waning world. And now we're definitely full tilt in a post-truth world. In fact, Greg Cahetty, one of the foremost Indigenous scientists in the world, he and I, with a South Korean neuroscientist, wrote a book called Critical Neurophilosophy and Indigenous Wisdom. And we had started out to write the book on just Indigenous wisdom and neuroscience, because everybody was gaga over neuroscience, except when we got our doctoral students giving us their state-of-the-art studies on things like generosity and honesty and such, we found that many of the studies were not supporting our position. And one of them was about honesty. And the conclusions were, oh, no, honesty is dishonesty is very important. It's a survival mechanism. And make a long story short, we changed the title from Neuroscience and Indigenous Wisdom. We coined the phrase critical philosophy and made the argument that Western science, even in neuroscience, is seeing through a Western dominant lens. At little conclusions like if a light went on in the brain that was the same place where in a previous laboratory experiment selfishness emerged, then people went, aha, there is no such thing as altruism, you know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, where it starts is from the beginning. If children are afraid of getting punishment, then they're going to lie about the source of that punishment. And so then that means there's that, you know, right away you have a moral. If they're not finding love and nurturing in the community, then they're going to lie in ways to get that. It begins with this colonial mindset, this uninvestigated worldview, and it comes from our Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. All of them have these kinds of, children are heard, and you know, and we're, you know, almost everything is stacked against the concept of truthfulness.
One thing that really struck me very deeply when I was growing up, coming from Ireland, it was like a Roman Catholic tradition, and this whole idea of original sin, I couldn't conceptually, it just couldn't enter my frame of mind, so much so for myself. And I say this as personal perspective, you know, guys listening in that have a deeply inspiring connection with, you know, with the church, I'm happy for you, just reporting honestly my personal experience with it. I didn't find it inspiring at all. So I chose to move away. And I think the startling moment for me is when I held my two daughters when they were just born. And, you know, when I journal afterwards, it's like, oh my God, like, well, literally, oh my God, how a society could be so influenced by a philosophical stance that there is an inherent already, there's an inherent badness in these two beautiful spirits, these two beautiful children coming in. It just, I don't think I've ever been the same since, just from that, in that moment, the felt perfection of them, of life, of love, of connection. I think it really eradicated forevermore any connection I would have had with that philosophical way. But, you know, there's a grief for me when I see and hear so many men, you know, in deep one-on-one in coaching, reaching out to guys. I've held space with so many men at this point, across multiple cultures, multiple religious, spiritual backgrounds. So just to go beyond the context of just one religion that I've reported and experienced personally, but there's such a deep-seated feeling of inadequacy, of being ashamed of just being a man. There's a deep personal grief with that. What in your experience, 4 hours, like, yeah, could you speak to that, please, as to the challenge of the modern man reconnecting with his, I suppose, fierce, primitive, primal, sacred, masculine core essence and pride in being a man?
Well, Mark, I think it's real important to recognize that the source that creates this feeling of inadequacy in men and in women comes from many, many sources. And the this idea of not being human that comes from our doctrine of discovery that is still alive and working in the world, this idea that if you're not baptized, you know, et cetera, like we talked about, that you're not a human being. Greg Cahetti and myself, Greg is perhaps the foremost living scientist, indigenous scientist. We wrote a book that was going to be called, Indigenous Worldview and Neuroscience. We thought that since everybody was gaga over neuroscience, that we would be able to convince people of the precepts, worldview precepts of indigenous people. So we had our doctoral students bring in state-of-the-art studies on things like generosity, honesty, courage. And we found that, in fact, the scientists were looking at things through a Western lens. And the science was saying that, deception is good, et cetera. But it goes deeper than that. Joseph Campbell is famous for saying that all of our behaviors ultimately come from our mythologies, and that our origin stories are the creation of those mythologies. And so let's take one of the probably most potent ones, our twin hero stories. Every culture has twin hero stories. Maybe they could be two girls, they could be two boys, they could be a boy and a girl. And The Navajo have a story called Where the Two Come to the Father, where twin boys go to get the tools so that they can climb to the top of the mountain. And of course, they have to fight monsters along the way. And the monsters are those things inside of us, like greed and jealousy, etc., dishonesty, lack of courage. And so in the Navajo story, the monster slayer is the name of the solar twin. And child born of the water is the lunar twin. And so Monster Slayer sees the monster with the long arms and says, "No problem, brother, I got it. I can kill it with a bow and arrow." So he draws an arrow out and puts it in the string and pulls back when Childborn of the Water stops him and says, "Brother, don't. He'll get that arrow before it gets to him because his arms are so long." Well, Monster Slayer says, "Well, what do you think we should do, brother?" And he says, "I think you should put the arrow away and we should sing to him." So Childborn of the Water and Monster Slayer put their arms around each other and they sing to the monster, and the monster, having been treated that way, lets them go. Well, this idea of complementarity between the solar and the lunar energy is very strong. You know, the Lakota have we had a full moon the other night is characterized by talking about the phases of the moon. And the phases of the moon were a conflict between the father, son, and mother or feminine wife moon. And the conflict was so strong that ultimately they separated. And every time that they got close, the feminine energy, the lunar energy, would cover its face a little bit, right? And depending on how close they were. And that describes the phases. And so these stories are of solar and lunar balance, which are very similar to right and left brain hemisphere work. I had a student who did her doctoral dissertation on hemisphere balance, and found that when optimal feelings were happening by watching a beautiful sounds and sights of nature film, the right and left hemispheres were very calm. There wasn't a lot of lights going on, but the corpus callosum was lit up, right? And so there's this place where the two become one. And yet in the dominant worldview about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, we moved away from nature. And in moving away from nature, we adopted the sun as our sole power and minimized the moon. In fact, you know, there's so many legends of the moon, you know, being evil or making you crazy. A cat just broke a bottle next to us. That's the sound that you heard. So I'm okay. But at any rate, the story goes on to show how the solar dominance was translated into masculine dominance. And we know what that is. We're still paying the price for that. And it comes from those origin stories that changed the story of complementarity about 8,000 years ago. So now we have Romulus and Remus, Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, Hercules and Iphicles. And in these cases, the solar twin either murders the lunar twin, or you don't know who the lunar twin is. I mean, many know who Hercules is, and few know who Iphicles is, right? And so I think these foundations need to be, we want to be able to get in touch with them and rebalance ourselves with this sense of seeking complementarity and polarities.
And speaking of seeking complementarity, how do you relate with the feminine in ways that honors, you know, the sacred masculine in yourself as a man, and honors the sacred feminine pole in the woman? And of course, just building in a sacred context, there's masculine and feminine in both male and female. Could you speak to Dakota and Lakota thought and indigenous thought on, you know, the differences between woman and man, and what's the most constructive way that guys can look at that, like an introduction to a new paradigm of looking at male and female and how we show up in marriage that will help us soften the rough edges of this inheritance of a divide between the sexes.
Sure. Well, you know, it's no secret that most indigenous cultures were matrilineal, and matriarchal. Why is that? Why, you know, does that mean women are better than men? No, it meant that women had certain inherent traits that were nurturing in ways that men often forgot, would be one way of saying it. For example, in the sun dance, our sacred sun dance, the men pierce, women don't pierce. They already suffer through labor. They already bleed. They already know how to nurture a baby. Whereas we don't have that sort of inclination biologically in the same way. So we kind of have given women a bit of an edge. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you and I were a member of a tribe, and we had been raided recently, and the menfolk are thinking about a retaliation by attacking the fort. This was in post-conquest. Keeping in mind that about 78% of all pre-contact indigenous people meet the criteria for peaceful societies. That's an important little disclaimer. But going back to a post-conquest time, so we're making the decision to go to war. So we go into that. Back in those days, our Anipi ceremonies, our Livingston purification, or as people sometimes call them, sweat lodges in the non-indigenous world. Only the men went in, and the women had their own. And so let's say you and I went in, and we decided that yes, we should go to war. So we would come out, and you would stand by the by the woman's lodge, waiting for the spokesman to come out, and she would come out, and you would say, "We have decided to go to war." And a woman would say something like, "Well, we certainly respect your wisdom and the process of your making that decision. However, we will not make the moccasins." Well, the men would not go to war. And why? Because their tradition was in those days not to go to war unless they wore brand new deerskin moccasins woven with chewed porcupine quills that the women used back before the beads were there. And so there's that sense of I could go on from one story after the other about the founding of the United States of America. And when they sent the woman was sent back from the Iroquois Confederacy. The power of a woman, there's not many drive-by shootings that are done by women, right? So we have to acknowledge that as a starting place. Then from there, we recognize that, even the feminist movement has been sort of problematic for in this understanding, right? Because the feminist movement was really about women taking the role of men than it was of this sense of different skills. And this does not disclude the alternative of the sexes of the gay people, because they were very much a part of the natural system. So whatever your inclination was to practice that way of being, that was what you did. But there were certain roles that were played. And so I think that we've got a lot of confusion today about what it means to be in relationship with men and women, and what those roles are all about, and how we have this balance of solar lunar. There's a statement that Howard Teich made to me one time many, many years ago that I walked in. He was at Sam Keen's house, who wrote Fire in the Belly. And he was given a presentation, and just as B and I walked in, he said, "And therefore, the union of the same is a prerequisite for the union of the opposite." And I just froze, and it just resonated, and I could see no one else kind of got it. And he winked at me, and later we became dear friends. But what he's saying is that for two people to get along, the man has to find balance between his own solar and lunar energies. And the woman has to be in the, also in that process of finding balance between her solar and lunar energies. And when there's that sympathetic collaboration of helping each other with those balancing efforts, that's what feeds and allows for the merger of what the sand paintings of the story I just told you, where the two come to the father. They don't show the two twins up on the hill, they show four. And the four are the representation of the solar and lunar in the man and the solar and lunar in the women. So I don't mean that, I don't know if these stories will resonate with the guys that are out there listening, but if we can be in the process of working toward our solar lunar balance, when should we be direct and strong? When should we be reflective and listening and passive? And when should we be both? And what we're watching in our wives, are they choosing the solar or the lunar for a good reason? And how do we find a sense of this idea of complementarity, this non-duality is very, very difficult to understand for folks. Hilary Webb writes about it in her book called Lianatan, when she speaks of the non-dual realities of the Indians of the Andes. But if you think about it as that positive and negative doesn't mean good and bad. And life is about always about positive and negatives, and how to find a balance between the two of them.
Yeah, what's striking me in when you're saying that, and I'm remembering a portion of the book speaking to matriarchal rule, what really hit home for myself was this idea by, I'm forgetting the quoted author, but that matriarchal rule was less from a common interpretation of its female rule, but it's more rule that was centralized around the feminine principle, which is inclusive of male. I know, and I feel listening to what you're saying there, 4 hours, it's like, you know, as myself, when I joined men's work in the last number of years and went deeper and deeper into my own emotional side, my intuitive side, reading those signs, that wisdom from within, getting in tune with my body and healing and nurturing myself coming into a more conscious relationship of my feminine aspect. I suppose that would be your lunar aspect. It's not a term I'd use that much. But by me integrating that within myself, if I'm understanding you correctly, that's the way of actually stepping into complementarity in relationship with your woman, because she predominantly the woman will be the one that will have a more intense access to that feminine pole. So for guys
now,
listening,
I'm not exactly sure I would agree with how you're phrasing that. I would say that it's not getting in touch with your lunar self. And I tend to over the years find that when you use lunar and solar, it has for more people a more profound and less conflicting outcome. But that's just, you know, but it's the same idea perhaps. But it's not so much getting in touch, a man getting in touch with his lunar in order to be able to understand a woman's solar, I guess would be how to say it. I think that's what you're getting at. I think it's more an understanding that that is the partnership that of the positive and negative that we're engaging. And you may need to get in touch with your solar to be able to do a better job at understanding a conflict that you're having with the opposite. So I think the idea is to think more broadly about the concept of complementarity, which is this and everything, all opposites have this potential balance point, and that the struggle for solar and lunar in the woman and the struggle for solar and lunar in the man, or the struggle for solar and lunar, in the bisexual or the gay or the lesbian, that struggle requires an empathy. That struggle requires an understanding that ultimately, if you stay with it and you use both your right and left hemisphere, you lose both solar and lunar during the process of negotiation or conflict, and that you respect that that's exactly the same thing that your partner is doing. That's the dynamic that you find when you're in nature. And I think that's the best I can explain.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying, Four Arrows. Could you speak, and maybe it's a natural meandering into the next topic, but I feel it's a very practical part of, you know, embodying the solar and lunar wisdom in an everyday relationship level. I was captivated in the book of the precept, conflict resolution as a return to community. But could you speak to that through the lens of, you know, marriage conflict?
That's such an important concept. Thank you for bringing it up, because it's crucial that if both of you are working on a solar and lunar, both partners of whatever relationship you have are working to find this harmony, this flowing balance in life, then the goal is obviously to stay in or reconnect into community. Now, if it's not possible, then one needs to have the wisdom, or one wants to have the wisdom, to be able to know that, and that's not easy. But the key of conflict resolution has always been about bringing people back into harmony and expanding this, what we call, or I think, who was it? I think Martin Brokenleg calls it the circle of blame, using blame in quotes, right? Because shame and blame do not exist really so much as teasing does. But that means that if one couple or one person creates a conflict, everybody is responsible in some way. And so we think about that in our culture. If there is tension between a couple, then what is in the media? What's in the job? What's going on with the children? What's happening in the larger world and the smaller world that contributes to that? And who can be brought in from those parts of the world that have a direct relationship to the conflict? And in so doing, the goal is, how do we bring people back into harmony? I'll give you a brief story that Ella Deloria, the aunt of Vine Deloria, tells, and that some people kind of have a hard time understanding also. And it was in the 1800s, and Lakota boys, teenagers, got in an argument about something, and they fought, and one boy killed the other. And so the boy that did the killing was asked to go into a teepee and stay there until the community decided what to do with him. Now, the option is alienation. The option could have been actually taking the boy's life. The options were on the table. Because the goal was, how do we bring people back into community, those two options, murder and or killing and alienation, are the farthest out. So what does that mean? That means the dialogue that transpired wasn't about, do we give them the death penalty or not, like we do, you know, in dominant culture. Do we put them in prison or not? It was, how do we get them back, you know, into community? Not, you know, what is the way we can make this right by punishment? And so ultimately they decided, after lots, I think 4 days of community talking, that they're not going to bring the boy back. And that this was a teenage anger that can be curbed and changed, and that the best thing that they could have would be to have their son be the boy that killed the other guy. So when the boy is let out of the the teepee, he is showered with gifts in a ceremony or a sacred ceremony of making a relative, like we talked about earlier, right? And that kind of shocks people. Wow, you mean they adopted the boy and showered him with gifts? But the bottom line is that that man became one of the great, great, great leaders of the Lakota. What would have happened had almost any of our dominant culture, payback or revenge or punishment have happened? And so we've got to start looking at that. That's the ultimate goal. Are there exceptions to being able to make that goal? Sure. But are we giving it the best solar lunar effort? No.
I absolutely love that your telling of the story, and I know it's described in full depth in the book itself. I just think of how petty I have been. So many times for years, I talk about like the first 12 years in marriage, guys listening in and will know I refer to that. It's just the amount of pettiness that I was bringing to situations where, so any feedback from my queen, whether valid or not, or she was reactive or she was grounded giving, it's like I'd get petty, I'd get defensive, and it would be like this default reaching for the gun of blame. It was like, yeah, but like, look at you and what you didn't do and what you did last week. And I think it was just, I can resonate with that story, maybe not to the levels of intensity of murder, but a couple of years ago when my beautiful queen, I feel that the language that comes through me, it was like, it was a symptom. I had invited a guy into her home and ended up over a number of weeks, it's like the connection, the energetic connection between my queen and this man became exceptionally close and I became really distant. There was a part of me where I just intuitively knew, it was like, I was just sick and tired of blaming. I mean, it's not that the blame wasn't live in my head. There was an old part of my mind, which was like, oh, F you for, and like other very hurtful name calling in my mind. It's like, oh, what you're doing in my house, in front of my kids, et cetera, et cetera. But when I sat with it, it was like, I'm just tired of that. And the more I sat with it, and I know you speak about going to nature. I went for several walks by myself and it's like, Mark, enough. You're like, no blame. There's no shame in yourself. There was a deep inner realization of what was happening, my queen and the dynamics with this guy was not like, it wasn't a crime. It was merely just a symptom of, clearly there was an imbalance in the ecosystem of our relationship and the ecosystem of our family and the ecosystem of the lives that we had created. And it was only from that perspective that I was able to enter a conversation with my queen and go, hey, there's no fault here. I'm not at fault. You're not at fault, but let's have a conversation. And it was the first time in my adult life that I ever had anything near the maturity to be able to enter a conflicting situation, but with no blame. And the rest is history. We're here three and a half years later. I mean, a blooming marriage, it's night and day, the reality, but it came from that type of perspective. So I invite guys listening in, just in listening into Four Arrows, it's just, where in your life can you bring that sort of attention to conflicts with your woman? Where can you bring that it's there's not a problem, it's just like a symptom or a realization that you have to look wider into the full expanse of your life and see where you can tweak things. Do my words,
That idea of guilt, shame, blame is a really good place for us to close. Your story is a really good place for us to close, because there's a story was told to me. I can't remember. I think it was somebody that translated a Ramari shaman that said this, but wherever it comes from, I think it's an indigenous precept. And that was a story of a lion who had just had a meal of an injured fawn and was sitting down, and a mouse walks in front of him, and the lion just instinctively takes his claws and whips out and grabs it and swallows it. And then he starts to become in what was called, and forgive me for using the term, Christian guilt, but there's a basis for that. And he went the rest of his life walking around sad and unhappy. What a bad lion I am. What a bad lion I am. And then he became a bully, et cetera, right? And then he talks about another lion that exactly the same thing happened. And he reached up and swallowed the mouse. But something inside that solar lunar balance and that idea of ultimately reconnecting with community and bringing back in the harmony clicked. And it was forgotten about because it was put deeply into the soul, the spirit that continues on after we die. And so the lion had a good, joyful time, and that was the end of that. So I'm going to leave that with you. And I want to thank you for your insightful and wonderful questions. And I hope that when I finally make my first trip to my homeland there in Ireland, that my wife and I can spend some time with you and your lady.
The door is open here always for you, Four Arrows, and thank you so much. It was a joy and a privilege to have your wisdom on. The guys, I've mentioned your book, Restoring the Kinship Worldview. I definitely recommend every guy check that out and purchase it, go deep into it. So transformative. Where online, Four Arrows, can guys that have listened in that are really inspired by your wisdom and your presence, where can they find you online?
Oh, my wife set up a website for me, Four Arrows Books. And so that's one place. But I find that if you just Google Four Arrows Indigenous Worldview, about 20 pages of videos and documentaries. And if anybody wants to get the worldview chart, I really recommend it. That is, it's a non-duality binary of 40 worldview precepts that are common manifestations in the dominant worldview, contrasting with those in the indigenous worldview that we've got to bring back in to bring us ourselves, like anthropocentrism versus non-anthropocentrism. And you just Google indigenous worldview Four Arrows and you'll go to a wonderful website that will have that chart for you to copy.
Four Arrows, thank you for that, guys. Full recommendation. You're probably deeply inspired, I imagine, at this point. Please do follow up with Four Arrows and all the resources, amazing embodied wisdom through eldership, to support us younger guys following in his beautiful footsteps. Four Arrows, thanks for coming in. Guys listening in, thank you. Want to acknowledge you for your time, for your commitment to listen to these powerful, potent conversations, and yeah, your willingness to show up powerfully as a man, as a husband, some of you fathers, in such a potent, heart-centered way with courage. And now Four Arrows will see us out with a short prayer in Lakota.
Oyate oyasin unchi wichalapo na oichak yako hetu wichazani washte unywa piktelo. Oyate oyasin chankuluta ochlamane oichak yako. Ihani lako wichu ankitum kashu wikitsu ye. Etakwe oyasin. Takwe oyasin. Ahoy.